Welcome, guys, to episode 32 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and my guest this week is strength and conditioning coach John Hoffman. Now, the reason why I've got John on the show is having met him at TSAC this year, he has a very unique story. The city of Sacramento actually hired him to be the strength and conditioning coach for their fire department. John is not a fireman. He had never gone through minimum standards before. So he was a civilian hired specifically to improve the wellness of the department. This podcast was fantastic in a couple of ways. Firstly, to hear the angle of a civilian coming into our profession. I know that the buy-in from even a fireman teaching wellness is a tough sell, but to have a civilian come in, it's pretty interesting hearing his story and how long it took him to get the buy-in from his guys. But then ultimately how much he invested and how much he was, valued by the department. And the second thing was just basically implementing a wellness program. When he came in, it was far from terrible, but, he really changed the direction of the wellness department, brought a lot more overall wellness, blood work and screening and that kind of thing, as well as changing the way that they were actually exercising and training not only the recruits, but the guys on the line too. So I am so happy that we're able to get John. I think his perspective is very unique. It'll definitely plant some seeds in some departments at maybe hiring a civilian for this position. We have firefighter wellness guys in our department, but we are also only a 4-station department. So I think it'd be hard to justify a civilian in that size. So great interview. I'm so glad we picked his brain. He's very, very highly regarded in the tactical strength and conditioning arena. So you guys are going to love this interview. I also want to take this moment to remind you, share the hell out of these episodes. Please rate us on iTunes. The more ratings we get, the more 5 stars we get, the more visible we are. We are now totally visible on Google. We're almost 30,000 downloads, 200 countries. So this continued expansion of listeners is really making a difference. And I think we're very visible now when people do search. But as I've said before, pick a favorite episode and share it. You know, if you have someone that is dying to learn about sleep deprivation, share Kirk Parsley. You know, there's so many different experts in so many different fields that there's one for everyone, one that'll be the hook in the mouth and then get people delving in. So without further ado, I bring to you John Hoffman. Enjoy. So welcome to the show, John. How are you doing?
Very well. How you doing, James?
Very good now. We had some difficulties last time with my crazy microphone, but we are all set to go. So I want to just kind of intro this interview with how we met, which is very, very recently. So I've been involved, I guess you could say, with the NSCA as an attendee for the last couple of years, attended the TSAC, Tactical Strength and Conditioning, which is where I've met several of my other guests, Jeff Nichols, Stu Smith, Mick Strelli's coming on soon. So I'm obviously very aware of you now, and I now look back at your catalog and see how much you have done for first responders. But I want to start setting the stage for the people that aren't familiar with your work. So where did you initially grow up, and what was your kind of upbringing like?
Great question, man. And there's some great names right there just to be mentioned with good friends of mine. But, man, Stu Smith, Jeff, wow. I grew up in New Jersey. My family actually – my mother's actually from England, and my dad is from Croatia. And so basically growing up in the south, outside of Philadelphia – and all my life played sports and been active, weightlifting. Went to college to the University of Massachusetts, Boston, where I played football. And then from there, I kind of progressed into an odd world of sprint kayaking. Yeah, I took up sprint kayaking after college with the ambitions of going to the Olympics. Needless to say, I did not make the Olympic team, But I did it for about 12 years. I lived at the as a resident athlete at the Olympic Training Center in Lake Placid. I got to compete for the U.S. on a number of occasions on at World Cup events. But I think that's really what set me in stone towards this whole coaching profession, because my undergraduate degree was in economics, and I thought I was going to go towards business. But during my stay at the Olympic Training Center, I was just enamored with the intelligence of how people train versus, you know, the old school thinking of just do it. This is how we do it. And with that being said, the sports doctors and everybody at the center said, hey, you know, you're going to have to grow up one day and get a real job. You know, why don't you get your master's degree in kinesiology or exercise science? And I think that's really when things started to change for me in terms of being a coach. I moved to California in 2003 to prepare for the Olympic trials at Oakland. And at that time, Sacramento was a great area to train at Lake Matoma. We had nationals here in 2001, so I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to come to California, get ready for the game, Olympic trials. And after 04, I did not make it, so I decided to move to Australia and train with the Australian Institute of Sport. And I lived there for about 6-7 months. And again, started to really gain more knowledge in terms of, you know, this whole idea of training and exercise and really what it was about. So I was really enamored with the mindset. You know, the physical component of it's one thing, but the idea of getting inside the athlete's mind was something that really drove me. You know, I thought we had to create a bridge and connect, you know, why we're doing what we're doing. And when I came back, I decided, you know, as always, just to stay loose, or I guess stay on top of interviewing skills. You know, I knew one day I'd have to get a job, so I'd always apply to jobs and go to interviews and just stay fresh with it, keep that skill set up, because I was getting older. I mean, I was getting to about 28 now, 29. And one day I saw a job posting, and the job posting was for a health and wellness coordinator for the fire department. And I said, oh, well, that sounds interesting. And I applied to it, not realizing it was actually in Sacramento. And there was about 800 applicants. I was one of the final four. I remember going to the interview. There was four candidates left. And the next day I got a phone call and they said, hey, do you want the job? And I said, can I think about it? And I thought about it for a little while. And I remember talking to a few colleagues, including Sean Skahane, who's the coach now for the Minnesota Wild. And, you know, he gave me some good advice, and I kind of reflected back and I kind of accepted, you know, I kind of did everything I wanted to do as an athlete, and I think I'm ready to move on to the next part of my life. And the one thing that really sold me was the idea of, one, there was no real strength and conditioning coaches out there in the field for public safety, fire, or law at that time. We're talking about 10, 11 years ago. And then on top of that, I always thought, well, you know, what greater way to be a great coach than to give back to those who protect us? You know, I get to help those who help everybody else. And so I called back the next day and I said, yeah, I want the job. I never asked how much money. I never asked anything of that. I thought, you know, that would come in time, and, you know, and it really didn't bother me. I was a poor athlete to begin with. There's not a lot of money in sprint kayaking. So that so that basically launched me off into a whole new direction, into a whole new world.
All right. So I guess the next question is, what spurred Sacramento to hire a civilian strength and conditioning coach versus have one of their own guys as a mentor?
Awesome. I'm glad you asked that. It really started in 1989 with a gentleman named Coach Al Beda, who, like, I consider like the grandfather. Al was a actually track and field coach here for UC Berkeley, American River College. He was the team manager for 96 Olympic team, 2000 Olympic team. He's in the Olympic Hall of Fame, track and field Hall of Fame. And in 89, the fire chief's son was on the track team. And he said, hey, do you think this stuff that you're doing would help our recruits? And Coach Al was like, yeah, I think it will. Absolutely. So they started to implement this fitness program around 89 at the academy level. And it was very successful. So they then proceeded to say, well, do you think this stuff would work for in-service? And he said, of course. So he started to do it on the side from his teaching and coaching. And it really did have a profound success. And I got to give it to him. He probably laid the foundation and made my job 1,000 times easier, because he had to deal with the old salty dogs, the guys who smoked cigarettes on the rigs, you know, and ate unhealthy and just said, hey, what has fitness got to do with my job? It has nothing to do with putting, you know, throwing ladders or pulling hose. And he was a good coach, and he always understood that, hey, I need to get inside these guys' heads so they want to do this, not need to do this. He did this to about, I think, till about 2001, 2002. But he also was getting older and was ready for retirement. And his whole emphasis at that time was, look, you guys need to hire a full-time person. This is a full-time job. And eventually, you know, with convincing and showing the numbers, the city signed off on it. And I became the first full-time coach. And he was on actually my hiring panel. And it was, yeah, it was a great compliment, actually. On the day I got hired, the next day, the chief said, you know who that old man was? And I said, I apologize, I don't. And he said, well, he gave you a great compliment. And I said, what was that? And he goes, don't worry about anybody else. That's your guy. He'll do fine.
Oh, wow. That is the hell of a compliment.
Yeah, I was blown away. And he was always a good mentor and still a good friend to this day.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's funny how someone back in the 80s has that observation. You have those guys that need the training now, because if we'd been around 150 years ago, where we were all working with our hands and carrying stones and blacksmiths and mucking out stables and all the other things, I think that's what people miss. We wouldn't need the training. We wouldn't need strength and conditioning coaches. But now we've become this technology-based society where we sit so much. That's, I think, where these people need to understand, is that we are not moving. Therefore, now we need to fill that void with people like yourself.
You know, I agree to a point, but I've really come to understand that, you know, the role of the coach is more than just, you know, moving and exercise. I think most people just need a little guidance and a little help. I think everybody wants a coach, you know, and to me, a coach is an educator. You know, it's easy to be a drill sergeant and tell somebody to work out, but to really take the time to understand what they're doing and listening and sincerely help them and educate them, I think that's the real missing link, you know. I mean, everybody can tell someone to work out, but we have more information nowadays at our hands, and yet we still don't do it.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah, I think it was almost too much information. I think it's that the analogy of, I think it's the fox that brags it has 400 different ways it can escape the hounds, and it has so many options that it actually just gets stuck and then it gets eaten. So I think if we deconstruct, you know, the way we eat and the way we train, I think that's how you get people motivated. When you show them that it's very, very simple and they don't need to have 1,000 different philosophies in training or eating.
Yeah, that is so true. I mean, it really comes down to keeping it simple. I mean, when I started working out, it was real simple. You know, you ate pretty good and you lifted weights and you did some workouts for whatever sport you were playing. It wasn't really complex. And over time, you know, more people promoting and whatever they have, they make it more convoluted. It's more confusing. And it's like, really, it's just simple. It's not, we're not curing cancer here.
No, exactly. All right, well, let's touch on that then. So you came from being an athlete yourself and then being a coach and teaching people specific movements for a specific skill, obviously in a sport-based environment. What did you see as a coach from that background when you first entered the fire department?
You know, when I came in, I really had no understanding of the fire service. You know, I was completely ignorant. Growing up back east, you know, my friends worked at Philly. A lot of my college's teammates, their dads were part of Boston Fire. And all I knew was, you know, the basics. And I didn't really understand this little fraternity world that exists. But I also understood that it was a team, that, you know, it kind of had that East Coast mentality of where you had to earn it. And I appreciated that. So I knew right away that it didn't matter what I said or what I did or what my credentials were. They really didn't care. I really had to show that I was there for their best interest. You know, the idea of, you know, exercise and stuff like that, they weren't going to listen to me. So, you know, even talking with Coach Beta at that time, I remember thinking, hey, I got to get inside their heads. I got to gain their trust just like any other coach. And that took time. You know, in the beginning, you know, nobody would talk to me. I would sit in my office by myself and just stare at the wall because I didn't have their trust. And that was the big component of it. And you had to spend a lot of time asking questions about them, getting involved. I would go to every drill. I would go to every station house. I would respect their station home. I would print out my daily log of, you know, on telestaff of who was working where every morning, and then get my call for my telephone sheet with all the houses and everything. And I would call the captain prior to going and say, "Captain, do you mind if I stop over?" There were days that they would say, "No, you can't. We're busy today." And I would be like, "Okay." And I would move on to the next. And I would spend a lot of time sometimes just sitting in a gas station parking lot making phone calls going, "Do you mind if I stop over and say hello?" And some would say yes, some would say no. And at the same time, I'm learning where all the stations were, learning, you know, how to get around the city, what would be the most efficient way to move around, learning their names, learning who was who, paying attention to the little details, learning who the captain was and memorizing their name before you arrived, knowing who the engineer was, how the firefighter was, always addressing them and such, you know, "Hello, Captain so-and-so, hello, engineer this," and learning those little details to show respect to what they do. Once you were indoor and you got invited, you really just started to pay attention. You listened, you observed, you watched. You didn't speak a lot. You watched how they, you know, came around the coffee table and interacted with each other. You watched how they did their daily schedules and how they went about their training and inspections. And if you have felt the need to ask a question, I always saw, ask a question about them, or what is this tool for? Could you explain to me? And it really was interesting because firefighters love what they do, and they would be happy to tell me on that component. You know, they thought I was just there to tell them to exercise, but really I wanted to understand what they did before I did any of that.
Yeah, exactly. And did I hear you mention that you actually went through the fire training as well with some of those guys?
I had done almost everything possible. We have a Task Force 7 here. I've done swift water rescue. I even have my own gear. It says the bottom rocker has Coach Hoffman on it.
Nice.
Which was a very great honor for me because they gave it to me. They gave me my own turnouts, my own helmet, my own shield. And it was a great honor. That's kind of a couple years later, but that's kind of how I knew I arrived or I was accepted.
Okay. Yeah. And I've observed, I guess the opposite side of your success story when I first came to my fire department. I won't name organizations or anything, but they had two different groups of people that came from two non-fire backgrounds. And I only heard stories about the first. And then the second came from a well-respected coaching establishment close to us, but there wasn't that understanding. It was such a disconnect to the point where at the end, one of the wellness presentations was they taught the guys how to make an oatmeal pancake, and then they walked them around the station twice, and that was their thing. And that was when I said, "All right, enough's enough. I'm gonna be part of the driving force that we take this over ourselves." So I'm glad that you told everyone about that experience, because it's great to hear how it would work. I've seen certainly how it doesn't work. If you go in there and you don't create the relationship, and you maybe even have that looking down your nose at the lowly fireman kind of attitude that I certainly heard with some of these people, you just destroyed any chance of getting any buy-in at all from police, fire, you know, the tactical community.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, I had to be very aware in the first few years of the job of how delicate the situation was. And you can't be stubborn and thinking, "Well, that's just ridiculous." Because it's a real thing. You know, for example, if you were to say, "Hey," I went to my chiefs and I said, "Well, what do you guys want me to do? You know, what is this? I don't know. There's nothing out there really, you know, like, yeah, there's the International Association of Firefighter Wellness Program, but that's just a bunch of words. Like, what do you guys want me to do?" And they said, "We don't know. We really don't know. Figure it out." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And so really being an athlete, you know, I sat down with a plan and I just started to develop it. And I used that time of downtime, I guess I could say, is where do I want, what do I foresee in 5 years? What do we need? You know, how can I be resourceful? And I'll give you a little thing. Like, I did 24-hour shifts, you know, with them. I requested if I could go and spend some time at the firehouse just to get inside their minds. But I didn't go to the easiest houses. I went straight to the guys who were the smoke jumpers and the badasses and the guys who were tough and eat nails for breakfast, right? I'm like, hey, either I'm going to be accepted or they're going to hate me. One or the other, but it's gonna happen. And so that was really helpful. And, of course, over time, you know, I'd come in and they'd be like, "Yeah, I know who you are. I don't care." But by the end of the 24 hour, they're like, "Hey, sit down, have some coffee with us." And I was like, "Oh, thank God they like me."
Yeah, if they talk to you, that's a good sign.
Yeah, and it really was. And so you start to see those walls fall down. You start to see those fears go away. You know, when you say, hey, I would like to establish a wellness screening program, people were fearful. And I used to think to myself, well, why are you fearful? This is helping you. And they said, well, I don't want the city to know anything. And I started to step back and go, that's a real fear. I got to embrace that. I have to understand and respect that fear, no matter how crazy I may think it is. It's for them. So then I had to build bridges with the union and administration and constantly just play this role. And you have to walk on eggshells. You have to be very cognizant of how you stand, what you say, your emails. I had to read my emails 3 times over to make sure that they came off appropriately and weren't misread as arrogant or condescending, you know. And so I always thought, okay, let's make this a system where my door is always open. I'm always here. If you want it, that's fine. If you don't, that's okay too. And I'm not going to be critical of you. And that's really where you start to evolve as a coach. You have to take a step back, put your ego at the door. And yeah, you will feel like you're on an island for a little while. But people don't see that now. They only see all the love that I get. But I'm like, you have to earn that. And in the beginning, it was very, very tough. And I laugh now going, yeah, there were days I came home going, what am I doing? This is, oh my gosh, these guys are so tough and I want to cry.
Yeah, we have that even as a firefighter with, you know, with our guys, you get resistance too. And I think, like you said, a lot of it comes from fear. I think it's fear of, you know, like you said, the employer is going to find out something and it's going to affect their job. But it's also just a fear of you holding a mirror up in front of them and saying, look, you know, this is a real thing. And if you don't address it, there's going to be issues down the line, whether it's your own health, whether it's not being able to do the job, whatever it is. And I think being that person holding that mirror, it's easier just to kick back than to actually have the courage to say, okay, yeah, today's the day I need to start changing things.
Yeah, and it really is. And you try to make it simple for them. You know, you try to give them a one priority to focus on, whether that be eating more spinach, you know, and I'm like, okay, that's a good start. I'll take it. You know, and little victories is what you're looking for to change a culture, because overall, that's what you want to do, is change the culture.
Absolutely. All right. So let's delve into that then. So you walked in, you know, you've created a relationship with the guys from Sacramento. So what was how did you roll out your initial wellness plan from the strength and conditioning side and also the wellness screen side?
So you have you have two approaches. One, you have the academy where you get to groom them. What was hard in the beginning is we had a hiring freeze for the first 5 years, so I didn't have the opportunity to train any young fire recruits and educate them. Over time, we started to have more. But also at the other, you come from the other direction. Okay, what do we need? You have to be very strategic in how you approach it. You can't overwhelm firefighters with emails and newsletters because they're already overwhelmed with a million other things. So you have to really figure out and get the feel for what the department is. How many, you know, how often should I send an email out that has educational information? That may sound ridiculous, but it's very important because a lot of times they would hit, you know, copy, paste, and delete all their emails. But when they start to tell you, hey, I really liked what you put in that article, that was really great, and I have a folder now in my email account just for you, coach, you're like, ah, oh, awesome. Okay, so maybe every other month is a good way to do this. Going around and always having a telephone available and knowing, letting them know that you're always there and available to them, you know, that was very important. You know, it's not a 9-to-5 gig. It was actually a 24-hour gig. My motto was, if you guys respond to a call, I'll respond to a call. And so you start to develop this trust. You have to be resourceful. There are no money. There is $0. I had no budget. So you had to be resourceful. And I would actually take money out of my own pocket. And I went around to each station to see their equipment. They already had it, thank goodness. But it was falling apart and it was breaking. So I took it upon myself to go and buy foam, leather, cables, cords, nuts, bolts. And I thought to myself, hey, if they see me taking pride in the equipment, maybe they too would take pride in the equipment. And really, firefighters do, right? They inspect their equipment every day. I took that and I said, look, I'm going to use this to my advantage, you know, use the rumor mill. Hey, this guy's actually coming out here and reupholstering our benches. He's, you know, getting his hands dirty and he's even paying with it out of his own pocket. And that, again, go to a small victory, a little more trust. Hey, he's taking – let's make sure that we use this stuff now. And then all of a sudden, the moment comes where you're like, all right, we need money and we need to establish, you know, wellness screening and these things. That is probably about 3-4 years away. But you had that one moment and of opportunity for me where it was a game changer. And we had an injured firefighter. And this injured firefighter was a salty dog and they had a back injury. And I just went to say to them as they were on modified duty, is there anything I can do to help? And they said, nah, it's hopeless. I've had this back injury for 10 odd years, 15, whatever. And I just sat down and I said, well, tell me about it. And injured firefighters, if they start to trust you, will kind of open up and tell you the whole process. And I said, well, maybe I can help. And this is where I threw myself into the research of low backs. And I said, this is my opportunity. I gotta get this one right. I gotta help this one. If I can help this one salty dog firefighter, it will change how we do things. And really, if I mess up, it'll probably ruin everything. But I was successful in helping them. They ended up losing 60 pounds because they didn't have any more pain. And then all of a sudden you saw the appearance of how firefighters were, hey, this guy's not so bad. And that's when I had the buy-in from the firefighters, and there's power in numbers. And that's when the administration said, all right, if you want to go for the AFG grant, go for it. So then I had my second opportunity. And I had to write my first grant, and I never knew how to do one. But we luckily had some people helping me, and I was always open to having help. You have to be. You can't do it alone. And I was like, we're going to get this. And we did. We got $800,000. And everybody was like, holy cow, we didn't think we were going to get it. But we did, and that's what started to change the entire world. We made it voluntary. We never made anything mandatory. My thing was, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. You don't be critical. You be more proactive. If guys came to the annual fitness assessments, which we did do, you know, 50 would do it. Year one, maybe year two, 100 would do it. And sometimes they would say, I don't want to do this. And you don't hound them. You don't beat on them. You don't know what they were exposed to or how the job may have affected them. You just go, that's okay. When you're ready, I'm here. And you build that, again, trust and respect. And the wellness screenings was the last component. And I literally had to call each firefighter and say, would you like to do this? And there were times that I actually had to walk them to the med center to do the tests. I put my job on the line a number of times where they would say, if there was a problem, coach, do I have your word that nothing's going to happen to me? And I would say, absolutely. And I would get into arguments with the doctors, and we'd had it written to the contract that they weren't allowed to say that they were unfit for duty. I worked very closely with risk management, ensuring that no information was given to the city and only to the firefighter. And I had to be on top of that. And I had to fight for the firefighters. I had to, you know, I guess bring my New Jersey attitude, as some people said, to break down those fears and create a winning environment. And basically, we had an 80% participation the first year, and everybody did it. And we were able to help a number of firefighters. And then the next thing that really changed how things go, again, blind luck, one of the union guys did it. And he said, year one, we did your thing, coach. Year two, I did it again. Year three, I had a disorder we found, and I went to workers' comp ready to lawyer up. And they said, no, you're covered. You did the wellness program. Look, one, two, didn't have it. Now you do. It's presumptive. And he was like, oh, my God, this is going to protect our firefighters. And that's really where we saw that we turned the corner. Now it was, hey, coach, when's it my turn to take the, you know, the wellness screenings? When's it my chance to go? When do I go? You know, and I didn't have to hunt them down anymore. They were coming to me.
Yeah, well, that is huge though, to be one of the driving forces for that. I'm very lucky. My forefathers in my department had already done that work, and I work for Anaheim out in California and Orange County, and all the departments I work for, that was in effect. And you're right, it gives you this amazing paper trail. Then if anything happens, you're like, well, my hearing was great last year, or you know, my vision, or whatever it was that you can actually stick, well, you know, blame, I guess you could say, on the job, you now have that paper trail. So that is a great way of looking at it as far as encouraging firemen and firefighters, excuse me, to get involved.
You know, it even goes back to like the first year we did our first annual fitness assessment. And I remember being told what this is, and we're going to do a mile and a half run, push-ups, sit-ups. And I go, okay, yeah, no problem. We can do that. You know, I just wanted to get the idea of what holding a drill was. And I remember watching, and everybody, this is like the first time they're getting to see who this guy was. I remember my good friend now, back then, going, I remember just meeting you and hating you. I hated everything about you when I first met you. And I'm like, that's crazy, you know. But really the point was we were doing the mile and a half test, and I was watching, and it was voluntary, and I thought, man, there's only 50 people doing this, like out of 600, because the mile and a half is too evasive. It's too much. Like, guys don't want to be embarrassed. This is not going to work. And so that's when we switched to the FDNY step mill. And, you know, people knock the Wellness Fitness Initiative and the fit, but I think it has its place, and it does what it's supposed to do. Do I need accurate, superior numbers? I don't think so. I think I just needed to, step one, get them to do it. Step two, make it consistent. And step three, use it as education. Then step four, hone in the numbers and bring in the closer data. You know, if they're not doing it, it doesn't matter how accurate the numbers are. So we took a step back. We changed it up to the Wellness Fitness Initiative on year two. And we went from 50 people to about 100. And they had me running all over the gym. Because even if we had the handouts and written instructions there, coach, how do you turn on the metronome? Okay, let me run over there. Coach, how do you turn on the step mill? Let me run over there. And it was a lot of work for 3 months, because it took about 3 months to get everybody through. But I was just happy that they were asking. I mean, I was literally just happy that they were asking, because that means they were going to do it. And if that's what I had to do to make their life easier, then that's what I had to do. That was my job in the beginning. And what was funny out of that was we did have an older firefighter who ran marathons and was in good shape. His VO2 numbers were very low. He came into my office and cursed me out, called me a lot of names. And I didn't take it personal. I just said, I apologize. Maybe my numbers are off. And we did it again, and they were poor, and he again cursed me out. That year, I was lucky enough to convince risk management, maybe during the city wellness component, could we offer a couple other tests just for firefighters, and we'll bring the crews in. Well, he did the spirometry test, and the nurse says, you know, this is not good. You need to see your doctor. And he cursed her out, but he did go see his doctor. And about a month later, he came back in and he apologized to me. And he said, you know, kid, this shit actually works. And if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be retiring healthy. And I was like, hey, I'm just glad you were able to catch whatever disorder you had. And he was like, this is pretty good shit, kid. And that right there, I was like, whew, you know, it was worth all the name calling. It was worth all of it, because your heart was in the right place. They just didn't know it, and they were fearful, and it was just a lack of, you know, they just weren't sure. And don't take it personal, you know, and that's really what it was. And that was another success story.
Yeah, there's so many of those, and I think that's another thing that the guys on the floor need to understand is when you're in the wellness department for the right reasons, your goal is to make them be able to do their job. Obviously, there's people's lives at stake, and there's no getting around that. But then to stick it to the man when they retire and have a long, long, healthy life. You just put your life on the line for 25, 30 years. Now go and, you know, go drink cocktails, play with your grandkids, do whatever. But the worst thing in the world is to devote your life to the fire service and then drop dead 2 years later.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, you know, I've seen that happen with certain individuals, and it breaks my heart. But as a coach, you know, I try to tell the new guys coming into the industry, or if you're working with fire or even law, you know, you got to put in that time. Yeah, I was running all over the place, getting called names and stuff, but you can't take it personal. Towards the end, you know, 9-10 years later, guys were going, hey, coach, how can I help you with the fitness assessments? Hey, everybody's doing this out of respect for coach. You know, and we started adding educational components during the fitness assessments, you know, and you got to do surveys, and you got to feel the pulse of the department. You know, you got to know everybody's name, and people, the chiefs used to laugh and go, you're the only guy in the department who knows everybody. And I'm like, that's my job, right? That's, I'm coach, and that's my job. And over time, it actually, they'll take the workload off your back. they'll become your greatest assets.
All right, so delving into that a little bit more. So what does your actual fitness assessment look like? What are the components? And also, what are the main parts of your wellness screen in the doctor's side?
Well, when we started, it was basically the Wellness Fitness Initiative. I thought it had its place, grip strength. We did vertical jump because they liked to do that. So if they like to do it, then maybe they'll do the others. We did the pull-ups, you know, standard plank. But over time, we evolved to more of a we added the side bridges. We added TRX low rows so we could identify, you know, push-pull ratios so we can identify shoulder injuries. We did the functional movement screen. We started to incorporate that. We still kept the other things, components. We started to use grip strength in a more proactive manner where we could monitor stress for those who were injured or actually maybe suffering from something, a mental issue, not maybe depression, but just maybe in the moody blues, I call it. And we started to take these things and kind of figure out, you know, what more can we do with these numbers? They, you know, it doesn't matter really in my eyes what tests we do. It's what we do with the numbers. And what are we going to do with this information? How are we going to use it? You know, how are we going to educate them? Because it really comes down with 600 members. It's first education. As one captain told me one time, we really appreciate the fact that you give us education and information so we can make the best choices for ourselves. You don't tell us it has to be this way. And so that's what you do. So push-ups, pull-ups, TRX rows, side bridges, planks, all that good stuff. The FDN step mill protocol, body composition. With the wellness side of it, I'm a big, big believer in monitoring your chronic inflammation. So one of the things I really wanted to make sure we got done was the CRP, the C-reactive protein. The first year we did it, we had enough money to do everybody with the treadmill stress test and EKG, the whole kit and caboodle. We also wanted to mainstream the scheduling of the USAR and HAZMAT drills. So I took part of the USAR physical, the HAZMAT physical, and I kind of made it a big bowl of jambalaya. So, and the DMV physical. So when you showed up, you didn't have to go three times a year. It was, you know, check, 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 done. And that made scheduling a lot easier for everybody. And so we wanted to make sure we got cholesterol. After year one with the wellness screening, we had to scale it back to make it more affordable. So we based it on age, and we did 50 and over because we had a pretty old department. We didn't hire for about 6-7 years. We didn't even have many 20-year-olds actually. So we went 50 and over every year, 40 and over every two, 30 and over every three. We just did blood work at this component, and that's why we call it a wellness screening. We don't call it a physical. We don't call it, you know, anything other than what it is. And the way we had it written in the contract was if there was an issue, you know, they're more than welcome to come to me, but I'm not a doctor. My advice would always be just follow up with your own healthcare provider. If the doctor did see something, that was his advice. I would encourage you to go check with your own doctor on this matter. And that's usually how guys liked it, and it worked. So we looked at inflammation, you know, your cholesterol. We looked at CBC, your full, you know, CBC panel, spirometry, obviously glucose. And then we were pretty successful with that. And risk management came back and said, hey, this is really working. Can we offer any other tests? So we started to progress to more cancer screenings now. And that's where it is right now.
Oh, that sounds pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, for $250 a firefighter, it was pretty affordable.
Absolutely. All right, so I want to touch on something that you said before. So when you first joined the department, you said there wasn't a probationary academy for 5 years. I agree 100% that the way you change the department is at the front door and where you set the bar. So when you finally were able to have a part in the academy, what was your input in that?
Yeah, I was in 07. I got hired. I had my first academy, and then we had a hiring freeze. So I was like, wow, this is great. And then all of a sudden we stopped. But I actually worked at the college academies at night and stuff like that. So I got my feet wet within the academy setting. And what I realized my role as the coach was to not only be a motivator, but an educator. disciplinary. The role of the coach in the academy is much different than the instructors, I believe. You're the coach. Let them be the instructors and let you be the coach. And there was that respect. You know, I did at this time have their trust, and they'd say, whatever you need, coach, you're the man. And you'd meet with them every day. You meet with the staff. You stay informed. How are the recruits doing? What's going on? What's on the schedule? Do you need them longer? Do you need me to take them shorter? Tell me. And you always are modifying your plan. But if you think about it, the way we held academies, the PT component, right, is the only time that they all work together. So if you had 50 recruits, you've got to manage 50 people. And so now you use it as a team building thing. You know, you use it as something to bring them together. I always tell them, you don't have to like each other, but you do have to respect each other. You do have to work together to do this. You know, and so we used, you know, a PT as a motivational tool, not as a punishment. The first priority was always strength. I realized over the years that conditioning is probably the easiest thing to accomplish in an academy or even a firefighter, because 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day on the grinder, they're just going to naturally get in good heart condition. But what we started to realize is they're not strong, and we need to keep them strong. We need to maximize, you know, their strength to the optimal levels to keep the injuries down. And then we even went as far as going, we need a little size on them, the hypertrophy. We need to keep a little size on them so they can handle 80 pounds of gear on them all day long. The guys who were really skinny and lean and had six-pack abs and wearing skinny jeans, they broke in 2 weeks.
Yep. That'd be me.
It's real important to keep them strong, you know, optimally strong, you know, and keep hitting that home. Like, guys, lifting up a heavy patient is power and strength. You know, I'm glad that you guys can do, you know, these high-intensity workouts, but we need to make sure you're strong. And it also provides, you know, a stronger hormonal balance and such. So we did a lot of resistance training and laid the foundation for the first few weeks. After that, then we would go into more, you know, intensity circuits or whatever you want to call it. We would have traditional workouts. We had our annual, you know, 343 lunges in honor of 9/11. And that was a big, big tradition I started. You know, guys loved doing that. We never had any injuries, you know, because they were strong. They could handle it.
So which movements did you use to create that strength?
Well, we always went, you know, day one, if we had our academies were Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, Wednesday's off. So we had 4 10s. And Monday would be a bilateral day. We would always do hexagon deadlifts, so hex bar deadlifts. We would do bilateral movements, so hex deadlift, bench press, pull-ups, your standard power movements. We would do kneeling overhead presses and to take the load off their back, not standing upright presses. And we basically do those exercises. And then what we would do like on a Thursday would be like a unilateral day. So everything was single leg, you know, the Bulgarian squat, you know, with unequal, uneven loaded. So they're a little more fatigued on Thursday. So we didn't have to give a lot of heavy weight. It was just the movement pattern itself, and being unequally loaded was difficult enough. So now we would do more lateral side to side, lateral step ups, Bulgarian squats, a single arm rows, you know, plank rows, you know, and we always made sure that we had more rows than presses, because I would stay involved with the staff and say, how many push ups did you give? And they would tell me, and I would go in and try to do twice as many rows.
Okay. To balance everything out.
Yeah.
All right. And then, so how did you, were you successful, shall I say, in getting the guys to maintain a strength and conditioning program after the academy?
Yeah. So that's how you train. The way I approached it is, in the beginning, I'm the coach, you do it my way. We're going to lay the foundation. Then we progress into phase two. We're going to make it more fun, more high intensity. We're going to do circuits. We're going to do all these traditional tower runs and stuff. And then phase three, what you start to do is, expose them to a variety of different training methodologies or tools. You expose TRX, you teach them kettlebells, you teach them Olympic lifts, you teach them medicine balls, and each day then had a different focus. They're already in great shape. You know, our academies were 24 weeks. They're in phenomenal shape. Now it's about education. We'd have nutrition lectures. And what your goal was to say is, hey, coach, I liked the kettlebells. Great, do them. Hey, coach, I liked interval runs. Great, do them. You know, you got to do something. And first and foremost, if you like it, you'll do it. And during their probationary period, we did have 6 and 12 month fitness evaluations. It wasn't mandatory, but everybody did it out of respect. And they knew that they had to maintain the same levels or not have the dramatic drop off. The 12 minute mile and a half was still, you know, hey, you need to do this. And we wanted to see a slight, you'll have a slight decrease, but we didn't want to see a huge drop off.
Yeah. And so did you see the classes that you started coaching, did you see an improvement in maintenance of overall health as they progressed through there, several years?
Yeah, absolutely. Because they would be like, hey, coach, I really liked, you know, and we made them keep journals, actually, of their workouts. Like, they would actually get a training journal with all their workouts, with all their loads, with all the weights they lifted, with everything we've done. So all they had to do was open up their book and go, oh, I'm going to do this today. And we cataloged it based on equipment, right? So if they liked kettlebells, they can just go, oh, I'm going to do this today. Because remember, it's about doing something. And during the probationary period is probably the most frustrating and difficult time for a young firefighter. They're nervous. They don't know what's going on. So if they're doing something 3 times a week, I'm happy, you know? That's where people got to understand, you know, you can control the academy and it's more like an athletic setting. But once they leave, it's on them now. You can only do so much. Like, remember, they're there to be firefighters. You know, they don't have 90 minutes a day to do all this stuff. And they're getting overwhelmed. And in the academy, the priority number one is, you know, being a firefighter, but fitness. Once they go on the line as a probie, man, fitness falls to the very bottom. They're trying to figure out how to cook. Who's the name, where to go, not to get lost, you know, what's on the rigs. They're so overwhelmed and so nervous that they forget that exercise is important. And that's where I was very successful in having the guys already online going, hey, kid, you going to work out today?
Yeah, and that's exactly what you need, because if you get a probie that thinks that working out is going to be perceived as a bad thing by his crew, he probably won't work out for that year.
Yeah, so that's really where, you know, it was a double-pronged approach, and it was successful, and it was just understood. We already had a well-established culture of, hey, exercise is important. They also knew, you know, you don't go crazy while on duty because Sacramento is very busy. So, you know, you keep it light, but do something. If you're on the medic, sometimes do nothing because our medics would get crushed. So we educated them on the importance of sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Jeff Nichols, actually, in the TSAC, one of the presentations that he gave that I love was that whole, you know, adrenal fatigue element. Yep. Where if you are stressed, absolutely move around, but don't be doing Fran that day.
Yeah, Jeff definitely would know with his background. I love Jeff.
Yeah, he's very blunt. I love him too. All right, so then I guess another area that I'm sure a lot of people are going to want me to ask you about is your academy full of recruits. I'm sure they're all in great shape, 24 weeks. I know Anaheim, when I was out there, they were very aggressive at cutting people if they couldn't make it as well. So how do you deal with the guys on the line? Not the ones that are out of shape that are coming to you saying, I want to change, but the ones that are giving resistance that are on that edge of truly not even being able to do their job anymore.
You know, that's the ultimate, you know, pinnacle, right? That guy. How do you get that guy? How do you get the guy who doesn't want to buy in? He's morbidly obese and he just tells you to, you know, screw off. Honestly, I use the power of numbers and I wait and patience. You know, I often tell people when you're working with firefighters, don't let your passion turn into frustration. You kind of have to wait that guy out, because I truly believe that there's always a reason why. It isn't just sometimes they're just angry. It could be a number of reasons, you know, and over time, if that person goes, hey, coach, and it did, you know, and it, when we had the fitness assessments, those guys would stand off to the corner and not disrupt anything. And they would just stand over there and just be like, I just got to be here, but I don't have to participate. And I was fine with that. Okay. That's your choice. But over time, you started to see that they'd show up in their PT gear and you're like, oh, year two, you're like, wait a second, what's this all about? Or you would just spend a little time. Hey, how you doing today? You know, how's life? You know, how was your shift? And a little small chit chat and build that rapport. And that's it. You walk away. And then maybe the next time you see them, you can have three more sentences. What I started to realize, or I observed, was, you know, those guys actually started to buy in. Like, I can't tell you how many stories we had. We had one guy who was quite morbidly obese. And I went to see him one day and he was down like 100 pounds. And I said, whoa, I didn't want to say anything in front of everybody, but I said, what's up, man? You look great. And he goes, Coach, Weight Watchers app. It's awesome. Don't tell anybody. I said, you got it. It stays with me. And it worked for him. And I was like, he goes, I just decided to do this, Coach. You know, you know, everyone else is working out. I don't feel embarrassed anymore. Awesome. I remember another guy who used to cook bacon grease in bacon. And he came to one of my drills and I said, man, you look incredible. He goes, well, you helped my daughter out. And she came home and was all pumped. And he figures I might as well get in shape too. And that was my strategy. If I had to go through your wife or your husband or your kid or your loved one, trust me, if I had to do that, I would. And if I was, and I believed in helping everybody in the fire service, not just the department members, but their kids, their wives, their husbands, their loved ones, anybody. If you said, hey, Coach, could you spend some time? Absolutely. If that's what's going to get me to help you, I'm going to go through them. And I call that going through the back door.
Yeah. And like you said, you're helping them by helping their family anyway. I mean, that's they are our family too in the fire service. So
absolutely. And so that's really where you start to, you know, again, you have to have different strategies and different tools. You can't sometimes come straight at them. And I always want people to understand, don't be critical. You know, hey, Coach, it started to become, instead of not doing the drill, it would be out of respect, Coach. I'm a little tired, man. We got our asses handed to us last night. You know, can I come back and do the fitness assessments? Absolutely. You let us know when, and I will be here for you. You don't go, oh, well, no, you can't schedule this, that, take it through your chain of command. And I've seen people do that. And I'm like, nah, man, I'm here for you. You just let me know when.
Yeah. Now, I want to touch on something that you mentioned. So the Weight Watchers thing, I have seen the most incredible results from the Fitbit. And I got to give massive kudos to the people behind that, because we're very lucky. We got almost a quarter mile track behind our station. And ever since the Fitbit started being, you know, given out and people buying their own, I see guys on the phone, but they're walking the track and people talking about how many steps, you know, they want to come climb stairs now, because then it's going to add to their stats and like the Weight Watchers thing. Some of these tools are really, you know, now they're developed and working properly, they're really, really starting to produce results. And I think it's fantastic.
It is. And I think what people, as a coach, you have to be strategic, though, how you use them. You know, I tried all those, you know, Biggest Loser competitions, but it didn't come off cool. You know what I mean? So I figured, you know, let's use this as, let's try to change the culture. Let's promote wellness. And then I would take other ideas from other stations, you know, and I'd give them the credit. Hey, station so-and-so is doing this thing and it seems to be working, you know, and I'd put it in my newsletter and I'd say, great job, you know, truck 10, whatever. And you go, because really your job is just to manage this program. You're not, you know, you're helping 600 firefighters, and your job is to give health and wellness an identity. And so when these guys go, hey, Coach, we did this fitness thing, or we did the Fitbit at this house and it worked. Hey, Coach, we did the Weight Watchers app. I would take all these things and go, awesome, let's share it with everyone else. You know, it's not my idea. It's not my program. It's yours. One day I'm going to die, and I hope this is still running. And those things are really great. I just found that when I started to try to do it, it wasn't cool, and it didn't really, even like boot camp classes and stuff, it didn't have the stature behind it. It didn't really have that lock-in. So those things are great, and they're tools, you know, and you can mention it to somebody, hey, they were doing the Weight Watchers app, and they're just other resources. And I think people need to understand that, you know, get them to listen to your firefighters. See what worked. Who am I to say that Weight Watchers app's not good, right? I was always like, oh, cool, awesome. And remember, one chief came to me when he retired. He was 350 pounds, and he said, Coach, I'm going to die. And I put the phone app on him, the Weight Watchers, and we gave him interval runs. He came back a year later, 195 pounds. I didn't even recognize him. Yeah, and then, like, you know, but it wasn't my idea. You have to give credit to the firefighters and go, you know, these guys did it, not me. I'm just like a bridge or a gateway to help this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's exactly how I feel with this podcast too. I'm by far an expert on any field, but I believe in that philosophy, teach a man to fish. So, you know, I bring all these incredible minds like yourself onto the show, but I do the same when I coach in my wellness department here in Reedy Creek. where I'll do a demo on, you know, deadlifts or foundation training or, you know, kettlebells or whatever it is, and knowing that it's only going to appeal to some people. But when you do enough of them and expose enough people, like there's one of my firemen that I ruck with at night, and we just walk around that track with a pack on. But when those people see that thing that appeals to them, like you said, whatever it is, the thing that they like to do, they're going to do it. But if you ram, this is the workout of the day around everyone's throats, there's going to only be a small percentage that go, oh, good, I like this.
Yeah, you know, and it's really true, exactly what you said. You can't ram it down their throat, you know. I don't believe there's any exercise program that doesn't work. You know, it all works. So who am I to say, hey, if you like long distance running, to not do it? I'm like, do it. It's about fitness anyway. Who cares? Like, they're doing something. So why are you trying to criticize them that they need to be more functional? You know, if they ask for your help, then you can provide it. But don't preach and jam it down their throat. Be happy that they're on the bike or that they're doing triathlons or, you know, this guy likes heavy weightlifting and power. Be happy that they're doing something.
Yeah. And I think you can also use their passion to introduce other things. So you have the runner and you start introduce them to the strength training side and be like, hey, this is going to give you more power and you'll probably run faster. Then they have a buy-in now.
Yeah, you know what? And I actually started creating, you know, a list of people who had specialties, triathletes, runners, swimmers. And if a person asked me, hey, coach, could you give me a program? I'd be like, you know what? You're probably better off talking to so-and-so because this is what they do very well. And that firefighter was appreciative. And that's really, you know, and all of a sudden you have like a swimming team. You're like, whoa, where'd this come from?
All right. Well, speaking of coaching, and you know, you talked about several cases where there was weight loss. I think that's one area that's misunderstood in our community is you want to lose weight, so you focus on getting in the gym, and obviously the nutrition side is totally lost. So I see this even in CrossFit gyms. People are in there day after day after day, really putting the work in, but eating like crap and not getting the results that they want. So do you have an overall kind of nutritional philosophy that you give to your guys?
You know, I always try to keep it simple. I do like the precision nutrition philosophy. I probably lean more towards that. But I mean, really look at it. There's three categories, really. You have low calorie, plant-based, and protein-based diets. You know, most diets have more in common than they don't. So if you had type 2 diabetes, you know, I'd probably go with a more protein, low carb, high protein, low carb diet. But if you had heart disease, I'd probably go more plant-based diet. In fact, I have a funny story. One of my firefighters texted me last night. He's lost 15 pounds with a high-protein, high-fat, low-carb diet. But he goes, I went and got my cholesterol, and it's through the roof. And I said, yeah, your problem isn't type 2 diabetes. Your problem's heart disease. I think you should go to a more plant-based diet. And he was like, yeah, that's what I thought too, but somebody told me to eat like a caveman. And I'm like, okay. Well, you know, I mean, that's fine, but what your body tells the story, and that's what it is. It's what is needed for this individual, and usually I'd say your blood work will tell us.
Absolutely. We had Rip Esselstein on the show a while ago now, you know, obviously from the Engine 2 diet, and I've seen that diet make my blood work incredible, so I can testify to that. But if you have disease that you're trying to reverse, I wouldn't recommend anything other than that. I think it's phenomenal.
No, because they're both an issue. Heart disease is one thing, but also type 2 is an epidemic. You know, I've had firefighters call me up and say, you have a second, coach, can you come see me? And I would stop by and I'd say, what's up? And they'd shut the door and I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. And they'd say, I'm kind of depressed. I've been really down. You know, things aren't going right. I just don't know what's going on. And I'd say, all right, well, let's get your blood work and let's take a look. And you'd come back and you'd see their blood glucose was through the roof, right? So obviously they're going to get the moody blues. They're going to get all that. And this one particular firefighter loved to take pictures of all his food. And so I'd go, so you think that whole pizza pie that you ate was really worth it? And we educated him on reducing his carb intake, and he lost 15 pounds, and he felt great. And he was like, oh, I didn't realize how much crap I was eating.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't. Especially the processed stuff. That seems to be, you know, I guess our generation, we were told, oh, you know, you want to eat healthy, then have a big bowl of pasta or whatever. And it's like, no, that's a big bowl of sugar, and they were lying to us.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I always go with not one philosophy, but what's best for that firefighter. If you were to, I'm not going to tell you not to eat ice cream, just put some blueberries in it and I'm happy.
Right. Now, what about sleep deprivation? Do you guys have, is it an issue that Sacramento takes seriously? And then do you have any things in place to try and help with that?
I do. Actually, I'm actually teaching this entire week for Yolo County on sleep and how the job affects them. You know, we can't change the job, right? We can't change the tones. We can't stop going on calls. But what can we do? Well, we can look at how the job first impacts their overall health in terms of sleep, what sleep does to them hormonally, what sleep does to them mentally, what sleep sometimes does to them physically. So if a firefighter's like, hey, I work out and eat right, I just can't lose weight, my first question usually is, how's your sleep? So then we'll go from there and say, all right, let's look at how we can use health and wellness to improve your well-being on your days off. I'm not telling you to stop your second job, and I'm not telling you to stop, you know, living your life, but maybe we can provide some strategies of, you know, relaxation, maybe breathing, maybe, you know, turning off your phone to a blue light, you know, the night shift, little things like that to get the momentum going. Sometimes we'll look at hormonal imbalances and be like, you know, yeah, you're 32 years old and your testosterone's like at 350. This is not good. You know, you're getting crushed. So maybe we need to add more resistance training into your program and look at your nutrition.
Right. And what's the shift schedule like in Sacramento?
It's typical 48-96.
48-96. Okay, because one of the things that I'm kind of trying to drive is the 24-72. I think that every first responder I've spoken to so far that does any kind of shift schedule like ours around the globe, there you can chop the numbers up however you want, but at the end of the day, you know, these guys are getting killed in a 24-hour shift or 48 hours. So I think the only way we're going to fix the first responder community is to give them more time off when they're done with their shifts. And there's a weird disconnect where our office workers, 40 hours is enough, and then, you know, you go home. But for some reason, the people whose lives are, you know, in their hands, we work them 56 hours a week. So I think that's a philosophy. I don't know if it'll happen in my career. I hope to God it will. But I think when we fix that, we're going to fix a lot of the other issues too.
You know, I think, you know, there was a recent study, I don't know if you saw it on Facebook, you know, the 24-48, the 48-96, and they looked at the Kelly schedule, you know, and the Kelly schedule is actually the worst in terms of sleep and recovery. But, you know, I think those battles are way above me, because I really, my job is to go, yeah, the 24-72 might be a good option, but then you have to look at the budget. Then you have to look at hiring more people. Then you have to look at, you know, a number of other factors that almost are an impossible battle, right? Because resources are already spread thin. So I'm like, well, how do we make shit shine, I guess? Or how can we improve this just a little bit and show that it's actually gaining momentum? Because, you know, people always want to fight these battles. For example, wellness programs. People want to start right off with standards. And I'm like, yeah, good luck with that, because you're just fighting an uphill battle. Well, we have to make it mandatory, non-punitive. I'm like, well, that's jumbo shrimp. That makes no sense. And so I'm like, you're going about it the wrong way. You cannot change a culture by forcing it down their throat. And you can't fight these big political battles. You need numbers. So you need to make it voluntary and change it slowly over time. And in 10 years, you'll have a phenomenal program where everybody will go, hey, we want to put into this. We need to get more money. Other than that, if you start with standards and, you know, roadblocks right away, you'll spend 10 years fighting that one battle and nobody will get help.
Yeah. I mean, definitely it's an elephant, as the saying goes. You got to eat it one bite at a time, and that's certainly the case with this. But I find it crazy that we've ended up with the 56-hour work week being the norm, and I think it's something that we need to reverse. But I don't doubt for a moment it's going to be a very long uphill battle. But just because it's cost X amount to run departments up to this point, you know, you're killing your men and women for your budget. So at some point, someone's got to say enough is enough, and we need to just allocate more money in our budget.
Yeah, I wish they would hire more people here in Sacramento. The workload is crushing our firefighters, but, you know, I just go, well, I guess that's the value of a health and wellness program. We can only do so much, and maybe we can help a few, but we can't save the world either.
No, exactly. But if each one of us, you know, has a voice, you can also change a country, you know, with the Absolutely. People working it.
Absolutely. You know, that's the one thing I always try to tell young coaches. You know, if you're going to be the coach in the fire service, you're not a firefighter. So understand that, you know, you're on the outside, and if they embrace you, that's great, but still know your role, know your place, you know, don't get caught up in the political world, because it's going to hinder you from doing your job, and your job is to protect them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of coaching, I wanted to get your, not opinion, but your feedback from TSAC, because I've mentioned it a few times. I've had guests from there, but you know, you're obviously a big part of that. So can you tell the people listening, you know, what TSAC is, how it was formed, and where it's kind of headed?
Yeah. You know, TSAC started, I think, about 12 years ago. Mark Stevenson, actually, you know, the TSAC award winner recipient this year. Mark is a great guy, very knowledgeable. He was helping out with the Colorado SWAT team, Colorado Springs SWAT team, quite a few years ago. And he saw this idea of having a tactical, you know, element into the strength and conditioning world. And he actually went to he was working there. He said, hey, I'd like to start this program. I think it's something that could be beneficial. And again, like anything else new, what do you mean? I'm not sure, but I think, you know, military law and fire could use this. And it evolved over time. And about 07, I reached out to them, the NSCA, you know, and I was a nobody. And I said, hey, you guys have this TSAC program. I'm a coach. I don't know what I'm doing, but maybe we could figure this out together. Could I help? And they were like, oh, my God, a fire guy? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're not a firefighter? I'm like, no, I'm just a coach. And so we started to work together, and people like Mick Sterling, you know, and him and I were introduced around the same time. And, you know, we started bouncing ideas off each other. Here's in Australia working with cops. I'm here in Sacramento working with fire. And I'm like, hey, Mick, what are you doing? What am I doing? And it really brought together in the beginning this network of professionals, Katie Sell, Dr. Dawes, Dr. Abel. You had these researchers starting to really go into this a little further. Dr. Alvar, you know, doing studies on firefighters. And the TSAC really brought together all these professionals and provided us a platform where we could share ideas and bounce off different, you know, programs on off each other and really let it evolve and see where we could go with this. And how could we take military stuff and apply it to fire and vice versa? And that's really how it started, and it evolved. Now it's actually at a really great, great level, where Tyler Christensen has done a phenomenal job in terms of expanding it to the practitioner's course. And now we have these professionals who've been doing it for over a decade, sharing their knowledge and teaching, you know, the fundamentals of what, you know, training tactical athletes are, because it is different than working in the athlete setting. And we have the practitioner's course, and we have the TSAC annual training. And really what we're doing is just sharing ideas until we have something more concrete. And each year it is becoming more concrete. We're seeing better programs from Rob Orr in Australia in terms of how to create standards, you know, and employment standards. We have the new Tactical Strength and Conditioning book. You know, it's a phenomenal book in terms of what exercises would be probably beneficial to tactical populations. You know, we said it earlier, there's a lot of bad crap out on the internet. Is a deadlift the best thing for them? Depends, but I would probably safe to say I would use a hex bar or something else that would reduce the chances of them hurting themselves while at the same time improving their performance. You know, with an athlete, you could say do an Olympic clean and go do it. If I gave an Olympic clean to my firefighters, I think most of them would kill themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hugely technical movement.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, it may be foundational and functional, but I'm like, yeah, but these guys sometimes can't walk and chew gum. So can we just do a kettlebell swing and keep it simple? And that's really what the tactical program is about. It's about sharing knowledge, sharing information. And then what we hope to do is expand it out to others. And we're seeing it happen. Milwaukee Fire Department has Jason Mibbs and Jordan Ponder, and they're doing a great job. And Jason's been able to hire an athletic trainer full time. We're seeing more coaches evolve. Vanessa Frost down in Texas, Sac Metro with Melissa Altering. So you're seeing other agencies start to really get this concept of hiring a strength and conditioning professional to take care of their tactical population. And it's, hey, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. We've already had this done. Let us just provide you some advice, because maybe it'll help you.
Yeah, I mean, I was blown away. I think only 2 years ago we went the first time, because it was in Orlando, and then we went to the regular NSCA one that has the TSAC component to it now, and then we went again, you know, where we met just this last time. But what blew me away was A, how much great information, you know, there was, a lot of it from people in the field and you know, Navy SEALs and all these areas that are completely pertinent. But the other thing that really solidified it for me is the speakers were all in each other's talks as well. So they, as you said, they were totally knowledge sharing, and they would talk about each other's lectures in their lectures and just bounce these ideas off each other. And I think that's what we need. You know, there is no one size fits all, as you said. So the more that we're exposed to, the more tools we have in our toolbox, the easier it's going to be for a department and an individual to find that key to their own wellness and be the best tactical athlete they can be.
So true. I've been involved in, you know, all different levels of athleticism and stuff. The tactical population and the coaches that you just spoke of, the Jeff Nichols, the Mick Sterlys, these guys, their heart is in the right place. It is about the tactical athlete. It is not about them. It's not about me. It's about the firefighters. And these guys have no egos, really, and they're really open, and no one should ever be afraid to walk up and say, hey, I have a question, because I know if anybody ever asked me, I'd be like, yeah, I'm more than happy to help, because they have open minds and they're willing to help, because at the end of the day, it really is about the military, the law officer, and the firefighter. We get frustrated as coaches from other professionals going, this is what you have to do. This is the only way to do it. And my first question is, you ever done a 24-hour shift? No. Then you're just working them out. You're not coaching them. And that really is the difference. And I'm like, you got to understand, these individuals, they've been inside it. They, you know, we know inside and out. I've shared their demons. I'm glad that you can work them out, but it's much more than that. And that's really what it's about. We want to share this idea of it's about protecting them.
Yeah, and it is such a unique animal as well. Like you said, there's so many components, not only on shift, but then the knock-on effect of what that 24-hour shift does to them on their days off as well. And, you know, it's the more you immerse yourself in that culture, and the more, like you said, you leave your pride at the door, and you're empathetic and trying to change other people and not making it about you, I think the more chance you got of success. But it is so multifaceted that it's complicated without being complicated. Once you take a step back and you understand all the elements, then you're like, okay, it's now simple. But if I didn't understand all the elements, the sleep deprivation, the PTSD, the things that you see, you know, the stress on the bodies, the zero from dead sleep to three stories up with a chainsaw in your hand, if you don't understand what that feels like, like you said at the beginning, you're not going to get the buy-in, and B, you're just going to give them all the wrong information and screw them up even more.
Yeah, and that really is a shame. I hate to see that, you know, when information is watered down or confusing, what health and wellness becomes, just on the fire side and law, it becomes a joke. And I'm like, man, you know, it doesn't have to be one way. It can be more holistic. And it shouldn't be a joke. It should be something that is actually real. And we've proven that with Sacramento and a number of other fire agencies. And it's like, well, this guy told me that, and that guy told me this. And I'm like, no, there should be an actual SOG in terms of health and wellness and information. You know, it all works, but let's fine tune it a little bit. You know, let's keep it tight, and let's make sure that we provide good information, not the best. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, we're not trying to, you know, we're just trying to prolong their life. I love what George Carbajal said at TSAC, and George is a great fireman as well as a great coach. And he said it the best. He goes, we've been putting out fires for over 100 years. It's not about fitness or working out. It's about health, wellness, and longevity. You don't need to be fit to fight fire. They've been doing it all their lives. It's about protecting them for a long career, and so they don't hurt.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And actually, George will be on the show in August.
Can't go wrong with George, dude. He is so smart, such a humble guy, and so brilliant. I mean, he's another one who's always been willing to help me along the way. And that's really what it is. You know, you're helping each other. What I try to tell people, really, I always start with, how do you define a healthy firefighter? And nobody really has a defined answer. And I always start, then give me these six questions and start with that. Do you exercise? I don't care what you do. Do something. It doesn't matter to me. Do you eat well? You don't have to eat perfect. You don't have to have six-pack abs. You just have to be, you know, eat well. do you get your annual physicals? You know, the blood work will tell us everything and the body tells the story. Are you tactically sound? I mean, let's be honest. Training saves your life. Exercise complements your job. It allows you to train harder, which reduces the unknowns, which helps people go home safely at night when the fire occurs. Are you mentally sound? You know, we've seen a number of issues. I don't like to use post-traumatic stress because in my eyes, I think we're using that, abusing that word a little too much. And it may be planting the wrong seeds in the wrong people's brains. But are you mentally sound? And then the final one is, do you have pain? You know, pain affects the other five. You know, I've seen guys take up the 5 pain pills a day just to do the job because, you know, they love being firefighters. But it'll affect their appetite. It affects their mental capacity. They won't exercise because of the fear of hurting more. They just want to save whatever they have to do the job. And I'm like, and that right there is your starting point. Start with one of those questions and then go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good questions, I think. And I think with the PTS, I get what you're saying. I think they're all interrelated. So I think if you just try and fix, you know, that one thing, then you miss the boat with the sleep deprivation, the nutrition and the exercise. And, you know, it's a big interrelated web and you have to fix them all.
Right. And what you're doing is creating priorities for this individual and helping them. You're not throwing everything at them. And so really, that's what you're trying to do, you know, mental health. You know, sometimes it could be this, they sleep shitty, right? Sometimes they're depressed without knowing it because their sleep, it sucks. So maybe focus on that and see, find ways to help them improve that.
Absolutely. Well, so I want to ask you one other question before we wrap up with my usual closing ones. But I know that very recently you're actually transitioning from Sacramento. So could you tell us about that?
Yes, actually, I recently left my position there, and I've now working with Elite Sports University, where we're establishing an entire tactical program for departments, law enforcement, and fire, where we will actually provide online education and content, basically everything that we kind of discuss specific to their needs. But it's also, we also provide train-the-trainer courses, 40-hour train-the-trainer courses. And our goal is to establish, again, an SOG and a peer-to-peer program where we would work with their coaches, such as yourself, and we provide data analysis, we provide the workouts, we set everything up so we can work directly with you as the coach, and then you could actually implement it with your department. But more importantly, everybody now has the same information. What often happens is people come in, or they'll take a course. Let's say, you know, Firefighter A takes a course. He gets this information, he gets this certificate, but he doesn't know what to do with the information, right? Great, I got my cert, I'm a peer fitness trainer, what do I do now? And our goal is to go, look, we'll give you the information, but now let's share this knowledge with your department so they will reach out to you for help. We need to get them to come to the peer fitness trainer. You can't go to them, it's not gonna work, or you're gonna spread yourself too thin, or you're gonna be overworked or overstressed. So why not provide the firefighters with the same information, plant that seed, let them watch the cancer screening one or the heart disease one, and then they, hey, coach, could you tell us about this a little bit more? And you'll have the answer. You'll be able to communicate to them. And really that's what we're doing, is we're going in and complementing a current program that's already been established to make it more concrete.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. I think it's definitely a tool people would need, because I know what I've seen with my wellness guys, you know, they'll get the piece of paper and that's all well and good. But even just from a regular coaching side, they haven't had the experience of doing the movements or teaching the movements, and there's that void there. So whether it's the coaching or understanding the blood work or whatever it is, I think that would be a great support system.
Yeah, the one thing I often found difficult with the fire programs are, you know, you get your grant, you get your training, you get your equipment, now what? You know, like, it just, what? What do we do now? And that's the missing piece, and that's what we, Elite University, that's what we're doing. We're going, this is what you do now, okay? And here's how you do it. And we're going to help you establish this thing so you can change the culture. So no matter what coach is replaced or what firefighter promotes up and a new guy comes in, the program is still in existence and you can get your return on your investment.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure I put the link to that in the show notes for the podcast. All right, so a couple of very short wrap-up questions. Is there a book that you recommend to people? It doesn't have to be even about what we're talking about.
Well, the one I just recently read was actually The Boys in the Boat, you know, BMX kayaker. It was about the 1936 U.S. Olympic rowing team out of Washington during the Berlin Games. That was to me, it was just a phenomenal book in terms of what these individuals had to overcome during the Great Depression. You think about our times now and how we have it hard. But these individuals, you know, were working jobs, trying to make a living. You know, the main character's father left them at like 10 years old, you know, and it just gives me some ideas of, you know, really, you know, how far we can go.
Right. And then you wrote a book, Beyond the Turnouts, is that right?
Yes, I did.
Is that still available in print?
Yes, it is, on Amazon. And I actually wrote that, and it's not a fitness book by any means, but an actual reference book for people who need information, doing research, certain things. I kind of condensed all the research when I was getting my master's. That was my master's project, and we basically turned it into a book.
Okay, fantastic. So I'll put a link to that as well. What about a movie and or documentary?
Oh, God, a movie or a documentary? God, I can't remember the last time I watched a movie, to be honest with you. I'm a Netflix guy, I guess.
Or it could be a TV show as well, if that's what you want.
I did like I forget what it was called. It was on Netflix, but it was about the strongman competition, the English gentleman.
Yeah, Eddie Hall.
Yeah, that was really fascinating to me because I don't know much about strongman. I know Rick Howard and other guys are really good coaches in that world, but it really opened my eyes to, you know, that world and, you know, how much work and really, to be honest with you, people knock it, but I'm like, how much athleticism is involved with it? It was very, very intriguing to me because I didn't know much about it, and that was really cool.
Yeah, he actually went on to become the world's strongest man this year. He won it.
Did he get it? That's awesome.
Yeah,
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, very cool. I'm going to see if I've reached out to him. I'm going to see if I can get him on the show as well. I think that would be a hell of a story. All right, so when you are not dealing with us high-maintenance firefighters, what do you do to decompress?
I'm actually trying to figure that out now. Actually, recently stepping away from Sacramento. I mean, I can't lie. I put my heart and soul into it. It was my entire life. I have a wife, but no children and a dog. That's about all I got. I got to say my wife was very understanding over the past 10 years because it really was. We would go to Giants games and try to have a little time to ourselves, and a firefighter would come up and say, "Coach, can I talk to you?" And it really was my entire life. And so now I'm actually on this new road of, you know, reinventing myself again, you know, going back to, you know, taking care of myself. Like, the one problem being a tactical coach is sometimes you get wrapped up taking care of everybody else, you neglect yourself. And so really that's what I'm doing now, is trying to figure that out.
Fantastic. And then where can people find you and your projects online?
You can find it at my website. It's 911tacticalperformance.com. It's a side consulting business along with Elite Sports University, where we provide, you know, training, online phone applications for workouts. But you can also reach out to me on Facebook. My email is jho618@comcast.net. I'm always open and willing to help anybody who asks for it. And that's pretty much it. I'm not a big social media guy. I try to stay away from it.
Yeah, I was until I started this bloody podcast. All right, John. Well, thank you so much. You have been a wealth of information, and I'm sure a lot of people that are either wanting to start wellness, you know, already well entrenched, are going to take a lot from this. I really enjoyed listening to you when we were at TSAC, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again over there. And maybe if I can get up to the Northern California area, we can even do a face-to-face in the future.
Dude, anytime I can help out, James, you please let me know. I'm always honored and thankful, you know, for this opportunity to be able to speak on your show. Just to be mentioned with some of the names that you just talked about is a great honor. I sometimes shock myself that I'm even being mentioned in the same league. So you're doing a great stuff. I know your podcast is actually very well respected. I know Mick is looking forward to it, and you keep up doing the great, great, great job you're doing.
Well, thank you, mate. Like I said, I'm just a conduit for people like you guys. So I appreciate it, and you have a great day, and I will speak to you again soon.
Awesome. Thank you.